Hey guys, this is Thomas Acord, February 22nd, 2015. It's a Sunday. Would be at church, but we're snowed in. Actually, the roads are all icy and they're canceling services at our church, Emmanuel Baptist Church. We were going to go to another church down the road, but they canceled their service as well. So we're stuck at home, and I figured I'd do a short podcast on the topic of classical education. Classical education. I read a recent article, I think from New York Times or Washington Post or something, about classical education and how it can cover a multitude of sins. There are plenty of articles coming out about it. It's kind of a burgeoning or coming, making a comeback in the West today. And a lot of people often ask me, what is classical education? How does it differ from public school? And so I'd like to talk about that a little bit. Talk about the benefits, perhaps some of the things we need to be careful of in classical education, and hopefully a vision for the future. First, classical education, well, it's Christian classical education. That's the official terminology used, CCE, Christian Classical Education. They have an Association of Christian Classical Schools. Association of Christian Classical Schools, you can just Google that and check it out, and there's a whole group. They put on conferences. I think they have their own internal accreditation, which doesn't mean anything in the eyes of government schools or anything like that, but they just have a way of policing themselves. The conferences they put on have been very beneficial, but let me get to what Christian classical education is. First, it's Christian, not in the sense of a Christian person, but it's Christian in worldview. And a lot of people will say, you know, you shouldn't use the word Christian except to define someone who is a Christian. For instance, there is no such thing as a Christian band. There's no such thing as a Christian plumber or whatever. But the movement self-identifies as Christian education. Christian in the sense that it's not Hindu, it's not Buddhist, it's not secular education. And the idea here is there is no neutrality. There is no neutral realm where there is just this bland, neutral, unbiased education. But that's exactly what the government public schools tout to be. This is a place where you can come in the government schools to receive a neutral, non-biased education, you know, bleached from all religious biases. You know, if there is going to be any religion, we'll give every religion equal airtime, and so on and so forth. But this idea of Christian education comes from the premise that there is no neutrality. So you're either for Christ or you're against him. You either scatter with him or gather with him, or you scatter. And this happens in worldview. So no matter what happens, we can never get rid of our biases. So if we're not Christians, if we're secular humanists, that's going to come out not just in the content we teach, but in the way we teach, in the way we give a view of life. It's going to wash over the children throughout the years that God has nothing to do with mathematics. You can believe in God, that's fine, but when you come here, that has nothing to do with your ability to do math. It has, God's existence, Jesus Christ, his death and resurrection, has nothing to do with biology, geology, chemistry, physical education, and now, as you see in the public schools, sex ed, gender equality enforcement clubs, and all kinds of other things. This, people are shocked. People are shocked, especially conservatives, to see these things coming out in the schools. But this is a logical consequence of rejecting God. They are not biased. That's the shock. People think, well, I thought they were biased. I thought they weren't going to know. There is no bias. There is no non-biased. There is no neutrality. They're going to enforce their morality. It's not whether they're going to enforce a certain morality or a certain worldview. It's which morality or worldview they're going to enforce. So secular humanism touts to be neutral, but it's not. I'm involved in Christian classical education. We can talk about that later. But so Christian, the first part is it's Christian, decidedly Christian. We're decidedly teaching our children about all of life, math, science, history, English, poetry, grammar, how to speak, how to play basketball, everything from a decidedly Christian worldview. And what this means, if I can summarize it really quickly, the Christian worldview says that God is the center of the universe. He's the center of all things, all knowledge, the center of our affections. And from him comes all things. So all knowledge of all subjects, right? So you can think of a circle in the middle and there's God, and all things emanating from him, tied back to him. And therefore they all have a coherence. They all unify together. And they are able to be understood across disciplines. So instead of thinking of just one, taking one area and blowing it up and making an idol of it, or making it bigger than all of these other things, are the particulars that find their proper place under his lordship. Another component of the Christian side of education, the Christian classical education, the Christian side, is that Christian parents have a mandate to raise their kids in a Christian education. Christian parents have a mandate from the Bible to raise their kids in a decidedly Christian education. Let me give you a few references here. I think Deuteronomy either 4 or 6, I always get them twisted, 4 or 6 were commanded that to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, and strength, right? And right after that, it tells us that we should teach these things to our children as we walk by the way, as we sit down, as we rise up, as we go in and come out. Write it on the doorposts, write it on the picture frames, write it on the gates. Talk of these things, teach them to our kids. Now, it says that in the Old Testament, it has a sort of a parallelism, right? It's not saying, love the Lord your God with the heart, okay? And then with your strength, and then with something else, some other tripartite of the human being. What it's saying is, do it with your whole being, everything. And then it goes and says, now, teach your kids about this when you rise up and when you sit down and when you go out and when you come in. It's not saying, okay, go in, check, go out, check, sit down, check. What it's saying is every single moment of the day, a whole organic way of living, teach this to your kids, enculturate your children, indoctrinate your children into this worldview of loving God, of who he is in every area of life. Now, let me ask you something. Will that happen in public education? No, it will not happen. They will be taught not to love their God, the Lord their God. They will be taught not to even think about him when it comes to every area of life. And they will be taught instead of thinking in a whole organic view, like I just described, they'll be taught to think in particulars, categories. You study math and then forget it, and go study biology and then forget it, and put it in a little category. And these categories will later on turn into total divisions of thought that will keep them from connecting ideas across disciplines, across fields of knowledge, so that many, many people today will often believe in God but do things totally contrary to what God says in his word. Why? Because, well, I can believe in God, but it has no effect on my sexual life. It has no effect on my ethical stance. It has no effect on my voting. It has no effect on how I raise my children, or what movies I watch, or how I dress, or whether or not I evangelize or attend church, or how I love my wife, or how I work for my employer. Now, I said a minute ago that we should indoctrinate our children. Now, you might react and be like, whoa, did I indoctrinate? But this is exactly the language that modern educators have used for the development of modern education as we see it in the public schools. R.J. Rushdooney has written a book called The Messianic Character of American Education, The Messianic Character of American Education, in which he documents, I don't know, dozens and dozens of people who have contributed to the ideological development of modern education in America as we know it today, and they've all used messianic language, okay, salvific language, divine language, when they talk about public schools and the things that we're doing with them and in them, the things that we should do. And his title summarizes it, that they treat education as it's the Messiah, as though it's salvation. And so their view, the secular humanists' view of modern public government schools, is salvific, salvation. It's divine. It's what will progress us on into the future, and therefore, it's all-encompassing. It's totalizing. It's absolute. It's they're not afraid to use the words like indoctrination. Yes, that's exactly what we're doing. So I'm not afraid to use that word either. That's what Deuteronomy teaches. It teaches enculturate, do everything, not merely 8 hours a day, but a whole worldview of lifestyle that is saturated with the love of God in every area of knowledge. That's what this is talking about. A whole, enculturate them in a worldview. Now, there's a few objections to saying, well, that was Deuteronomy. You know, that's Old Testament, and that was for a religious national group of people. And today we live in a secular society. We live in the New Testament times, the New Covenant age, and we're not just an insular, inward-focused people. We're an evangelistic people, right? So people want to send their kids to schools to evangelize the kids in the schools, and that's a very worthy endeavor. My cousin does that with her kids. So people would say, well, that was the Old Testament times. This is New Testament. We're not commanded to be like our little enclave and seal ourselves off from the world. We're supposed to go out and be evangelistic. And I would say yes, but however, the exact same language is used again in the New Testament, in Ephesians. Let me find it really quick. This is Ephesians 6. Chapter 6, verse 4. Let me read it to you. Fathers, so the command is to whom? To fathers, not to teachers, not to people that work for the government, but fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. In the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And you think, oh, well, that's nice, just kind of raise them Christian, you know, bring them up and give them Christian values. But that's not what it's saying. The word translated from discipline or instruction, depending on which version you're using, the Greek word is paideia. And if you look that word up, just go to BibleHub.com, and it'll give you the Greek there. It's a really easy tool to use. Ephesians 6, chapter 4. Paideia is a complicated word. It's not a word that you could define with one sentence. It's like Doug Wilson says, it's like democracy. You define democracy. Well, you know, how much time do you have? I mean, there's whole books of history written on democracy. Well, the same thing is true of paideia. The same thing is true of paideia. Paideia means, in short, the entire upbringing of a child. The entire upbringing of a child doesn't mean merely instruction, you know, rules given to someone. It's everything. It's the enculturation of the child, the enculturation of a child. And he says, do it in the enculturation of the Lord. Do it in the enculturation of the Lord. So imagine if Paul were around today and he said, hey, go out and make the democracy of the Lord. And you would say, whoa, that's political. That's them's fighting words there. You're saying too much here. We're getting beyond the four walls of our little religious circle of the church. You know, we're stepping now into the public sphere and saying Christianity is something out there and not something merely inside our hearts. And Paul would say, it's exactly right. It's exactly what I'm saying. Raise them in the paideia of the Lord, which is the enculturation of the Lord. And what does that mean? What do you need to do that? You need a culture. Right? To enculturate them, you need a culture. You need a culture of movies and music and art and language and music and activities and hobbies and skills and a work ethic, a view of life, a view of sexuality and gender and war and peace and everything. You need to have Christians in the sciences, in the arts, in the humanities. Everywhere, top, bottom, all throughout the world, enculturate your children in the Lord. Now, Paul, you may think, wow, this is a big task. Paul gave this task to Ephesians who did not have a Christian culture, right? He gave this task to a bunch of Christians who were living in a pagan society. And so you can imagine the people would say, well, Paul, we don't have a Christian culture. We don't have anything with which to enculturate them. And Paul is saying, essentially, make one, create one, right? So you don't have one, make it from scratch. Now, we live 2,000 years later. That's a big task. We live 2,000 years later, and you might say the same thing today. Well, look, we don't have much of a Christian culture left anymore, right? It's largely secular. If anything, we have an echo of a Christian past that still kind of is around, that causes people who reject Christianity to still hold to the morality of Christianity. But we don't have a Christian culture anymore. But so you're right, we don't have one anymore, and this we have a great task before us. However, we do have 2,000 years of Christian history to rely upon. Okay, we do have 2,000 years of Christian history, Christian culture, in various places, in the West, largely in the West, to rely upon. And that's where you get the classical side of this Christian education. We're Christian in worldview, unashamed Christian. We're going to teach Christian. We're going to teach science from a Christian point of view, using the Bible as our lens to understand everything: geology, fossils, the age of the Earth, tectonic plates, gravity, the spin of the Earth, the age of the solar system, and dinosaurs and everything. And we're going to be Christian in how we engage the whole mind, and we're going to be Christian throughout the centuries. We're going to rely upon the culture. So as we enculturate our children, we're going to rely and draw from the Christian influence of the West throughout the centuries. And this is where you get into the classical side. So all of that previous stuff I just said was the Christian side of this education. And the next part is the classical side of this education. So what makes it classical is that we're drawing upon a rich tradition of Western heritage, right? Western heritage, which has led to the development of the world as we know it today. Now, there have been other streams of development, such as the Far East and other cultures in Africa, but largely the world is the way it is today because of the West. And Christianity, by God's providence, has followed or led the Western development of the world. And so in the injunction in the New Testament in Ephesians 6, verse 4, Christian parents are told, enculturate your children in the Lord. Bring them up in the enculturation of the Lord, which means you have to have a culture. To enculturate someone, you have to have a culture. Or else, my friends, your children will learn the culture of somebody, right? There are a lot of Christian kids who they go to church, but they're singing the songs of the world, and they dress like the world, and they have the values of the world. And what Paul is telling the parents to do is bring them up in all of that in the Lord. So to create a culture, we need a culture. We really don't have one anymore today, but we have the heritage of one throughout the centuries, and we're going to rely upon that and draw from it. And so the classical side is learning from the best of both Christian and pagan authors in the Western heritage throughout the centuries, stretching all the way back to Greece and Rome and the medieval ages and the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and even the modern period and the late modern period that we live in today. And the reason why we draw both from Christian and pagan sources is because not only were both, influential, the pagan sources as well, it's because in God's providence, in God's common grace, pagans have good things to say throughout here and there. You take the good and you spit out the bad. So we take the best of what's offered to us throughout the centuries. We take the best of it, the most enduring works of art and literature and philosophy and histories and ideas, and we take them and we teach the kids how God has worked in history, and how humanity has always been the same. Humanity has always experienced loss and pain and suffering and longing and love and a sense of the divine in their hearts, even though they couldn't feel for him. Like Paul said in Acts 17, they grope about, but he's not far from each one of us. And so this is what we do. Another analogy used is that just like the Israelites, when they left Egypt, they plundered the Egyptians for all their gold and treasures. So we too, as Christians, are plundering the secular society, secular pagans, throughout the centuries, of all the good things that they have. We're plundering Greece of its love of knowledge. We're plundering the Romans, some of them, for their rhetoric. Like Cicero wrote his book on speaking and rhetoric. We're plundering the medieval ages. We're plundering history. We're plundering it all for our good and advancement, for the glory of God through that. So we're taking it all and filtering it through a Christian worldview lens, and using it for God. So that's, in a nutshell, that's Christian classical education. Now, I want to say something in reference to what is happening today. So I mentioned earlier that there's no neutrality, and that you can either have a secular pagan upbringing, in including education, or you can have a Christian education and upbringing and acculturation into a worldview. And there are no neutral options. Those are the two options. And that in the Bible, in Deuteronomy and Ephesians, so Old and New Testament, the people of God are commanded to bring their children up in an enculturation of godliness of the Lord. So we have an injunction to raise our own kids. Now, this does not mean that you have to be the educator, that you have to be the teacher of your children. So parents are taught, I got this from Jim Nance, I think, or someone from a Christian classical conference that I saw. You don't have to be, just like your parents are told to provide, they're commanded to provide for their children. You have to provide for your own household. That doesn't mean that you have to build the house or that you have to be the farmer, right? You can go to the store and buy food. So you don't have to be the educator. You just need to make sure that they're being educated properly in a Christian worldview. And that doesn't mean in a Christian school that throws in prayer at the end of the day, but that's pretty much otherwise exactly like public schools. No, in a Christian worldview, what that looks like is you're not aiming for ACT scores. You're not aiming for college. You're aiming for virtue. You're aiming for Christ. You're aiming for Christianity. You're aiming for godliness. You're aiming for a whole person. So that's what we're aiming for. Now, again, I wanted to say just one more thing about education in general. Today, in modern education, the children are taught what to think, but they're not taught how to think. They're taught what to think, but they're not taught how to think. They're taught from pre-K all the way up in through college. They're taught merely to memorize a bunch of facts and regurgitate them on a test. And the people who can do that the best are the people who succeed. The people who can memorize facts and give it back to you are the people who get great grades. Now, does that mean someone is smart, someone is wise, someone can discern truth from error? No. All they're being taught to do is to be good little machines that can work in a factory. And oddly enough, that's exactly the worldview that modern education, the type of people that modern education seeks to inculcate. If you'll read a lot of the literature, again, I refer you to Rush Dooney's The Messianic Character of Christian Education. He has large, long quotes from these people themselves. And this is what we saw most recently in the debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye. Ken Ham and Bill Nye debated, and Bill Nye's position was essentially, we should not allow creationism to be taught in schools because it's going to hinder our ability to compete on the global scale. To compete in the global market, it's going to hinder our ability to produce things and to advance in science. What is he saying? He's not saying it's going to hinder thought. It's going to hinder free inquiry, right? It's going to hinder the freedom to think outside the box, to think new thoughts. That's not what he's saying. It's going to hinder our ability to produce stuff. It's going to hinder people's ability to be good little factory employees who don't look to their left or to their right, or don't ask questions, or don't question the authorities. It's going to hinder that ability. It's going to hinder our ability to just do what we're told. It's going to hinder our ability to go along with the flow and to produce a lot of things like a communist state, as though we're in some kind of arms race, our production race against the other countries. That's not the goal of life. The goal of life is not to produce this beautiful machine, this tower, this modernized Tower of Babel, a sort of a communist state. The goal of what we're doing here is to produce whole humans who can think, who know how to think, not merely what to think, but who know how to think. And that's where the trivium comes in knowing how to think. The trivium, yeah, so the classical education hinges on something called the trivium. And the trivium is just Latin for the three ways. The three ways, or the three roads. Essentially, the three roads, the three ways are grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Grammar, and these are at the same time, they are a way of teaching, so they're a pedagogy, and they're a way of human development. And this is something that has been recognized throughout the centuries. This wasn't something we invented, or the medieval ages invented, or the Romans invented, or the Greeks, or the Hebrews. This is something that all cultures have recognized. Grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So you have grammar. Grammar is the stage in human development where you want to memorize a lot of facts, right? The children, newborns all the way up till age 10 or 12, they're just memorizing a lot of facts. They'll repeat everything you tell them. They just want you, they're learning new colors. They're learning a new language, for goodness sakes. And they learn it in a short period of time. They see or hear sounds and they repeat them. A train passes by and they make the sound right after it. Or you say bird and they say bird. And they're just wanting to repeat and learn. They're like a sponge. They're just picking up everything. That's the grammar stage for as far as child, you know, human development. The logic stage is the next stage where the children are starting to say, nuh-uh, but why? Well, you told her she could do that, why can't I? They're starting to argue, they're starting to use logic, they're starting to connect facts together. And so you start to teach them that way. So you teach with the grain. In the grammar stage, they're wanting to learn a lot of facts, and so you teach them a lot of facts. You have them chant songs, for instance. There's songs they can chant, like the ABCs, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and you remember that from your childhood. Well, you have them chant a lot of songs. You have them chant Latin conjugations. Why? They don't know what Latin is, but they will one day. We're gonna teach it to them one day. You have them chant the states, you know, the different states of America, the kings of England. You have them chant all kinds of things and memorize and regurgitate. But then, unlike the modern school that keeps them in that stage, now think about that. The modern system keeps them in that infantile stage all throughout their lives. But in the trivium wants them to grow up. Okay, so when they hit 12, instead of telling them, don't ask me that question, stop questioning me, instead we tell them, okay, you want to start questioning? Learn how to question well. And we start teaching them logic. Logic 1, logic 2, fallacies, informal and formal. And we teach it from a Christian worldview, right? In the beginning was the logos, was the word, was the logos. In the beginning was the rationality, right? So the only reason we can even think rationally and logically is because God is rational and created a rational universe and made us rational beings, and he put knowledge in our mind. And God, you know, logic isn't something that God adheres to. Logic is an attribute of God himself. And so when we think logically, we're thinking with God. We're thinking right thoughts. Now, that's just a little taste of how all subjects fit in. But we teach them logic. Logic is the second stage. And then when they hit about 15 or whatever, or 16, they want to start expressing themselves, right? Like, who am I? And I want to learn how to, you know, say things and do things in my own way. I want to be my own person. I don't want to live with my parents anymore and all that. Well, again, what the modern way of raising kids, and not just education, but raising kids, what the modern way does is it says, no, just stay a child, obey your parents, come home at this time, and they buck, and the kids buck against that. Well, rightly so, if you view the development of children, of humans, from this classical way that all cultures have recognized. And I'll talk more about that in a second. But the classical way says, no, they want to move into the next stage, which is rhetoric. And that's the hardest stage to move into. It's adulthood. And we need to facilitate that. Instead of hindering our children, making 18-year-olds still act like children and 26-year-olds under the Affordable Health Care Act still consider children, no. We want them by the age of 15 to be acting like adults, right? We want them to be growing up, because in older cultures, people who were 15 and around that age, they were already considered adults. That was their coming of age. I mean, Jesus, God came to Mary, who was probably 14 or 15, and said, "Hey, you're going to carry Jesus. You're going to be pregnant." She was a betrothed to Joseph, probably around the age of 14 or 15. And so that's not uncommon. You know, Romeo and Juliet, they fell in love and got married, and she was probably 14 or 15. We need to be doing this. Everybody knows this. Why would God create the human body to physically develop and be ready for love at around 14 or 15, but not want us to do anything about it until around, you know, in their mid-20s or upper 20s? This is ridiculous. We perpetuate childhood today, and it's not a coincidence. It's a direct development, a direct consequence of our education and our view of child rearing. And this view, this classical view, which all cultures have recognized, says the next stage at 15 or so is rhetoric. Raise them there. That's the stage of expression, right? So think about music. Think about it like an analogy we can use with music. Music, you learn the theory. You learn how the notation works and everything. That's the grammar. And then you start to connect those notes together to form a tune. That's logic. And then you get so good at that that you can express yourself. You can make your own song. You can write your own music. Express yourself. Poetry, art, that is rhetoric. And not just that, but also speaking. Speaking is another way. You learn the grammar, right? The words and the syntax and whatever. And then you learn how to form sentences. That's logic. And then you learn how to stand before people and express yourself confidently, respectfully, yet winsomely and boldly. That's rhetoric. And no doubt, it's no coincidence, therefore, that you see those exact same subjects in the trivium, in Christian and classical education. You see grammar. We're teaching rigorously grammar, both in English and especially in Latin. And we're teaching in logic. We're teaching the languages more and more so, or having them read and write a lot and memorize poetry, long lines of poetry. Why? Because it teaches them how to think well. And then in rhetoric, we're teaching them oratory and rhetoric and how to stand up and speak and how to write and these types of things. So that's what we're aiming for, not teaching them merely what to think and perpetuating childhood, but teaching them how to think for themselves. And this includes putting forth all kinds of non-Christian ideas in front of them. Just about every classical school curriculum I've seen includes readings, at least in the upper schools, from Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto and Thomas More or Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, whichever one wrote Leviathan. I've seen Mein Kampf. I've seen a lot of novels that are not Christian good little novels. There are tons of pagan and unchristian literature, because we're not trying to create a Christian bubble. We are not trying to create a Christian bubble. We are trying to teach our kids to fight well, to take over the world. And just being honest, it's global dominion. We're taking the culture, the dominion mandate given in Genesis and renewed again and heightened in Matthew. You know, go and make disciples of all the nations, teaching them to baptize, teaching them to obey all that I commanded you. Everything. We want global conversion, not by the sword like Islam, not by force, but by force of ideas, by the winsome power of the gospel, the awesome power of the gospel. And so we're taking that everywhere. That's what we're doing. And we're teaching our kids to do that with the ideas of the pagans throughout the centuries, so that when they see ideas from pagans, from non-Christians today, one, they're not duped by them. They see them, and it's not the first time they ever saw, you know, this idea. They've seen it before, and they've seen it throughout the centuries, and it's not new. Nothing's new under the sun. It's not like a new weird problem today, like the homosexual movement claims we're different today. Right? That's a big argument from people today. Well, times are different today. Humanity is different. Society has developed. No, it hasn't. It hasn't developed at all. God made humans. We haven't evolved. God created us, and we're always the same. What the Bible says about humanity is true. It was true back then. It was true 1,000 years ago. It was true today. It's going to be true 1,000 years from now. We all have the same desires, the same longings, the same feelings, the same sins, the same excuses, the same failures. We have the same capabilities for beauty and good and art and virtue and honor, and we have the same moral calamities. And nothing is new under the sun, and our children will not be duped by that, because they've been steeped in it throughout the centuries. So those are some key points that emanate from my thoughts of a Christian classical education. And it's really a worldview. If you've picked up on this, this isn't merely send your kids off to this school and then they come home and watch a bunch of TV or whatever. Or you send them to one of these schools, but you really value sports, right? You get them out of class early so they can go swimming or hiking or baseball or football or whatever. This is a worldview that values the life of the mind. We are unlike the animals in the sense, not merely that we have a soul, but that we have a mind. We can think. We can think like our God thinks. He's a thinking God. He's rational, and we're rational. And we love God with our mind, with our whole mind. And that's what we want to do. We want to love God with our mind in everything, in every thought. Take every thought captive, Paul says. This is a battle of ideas. And it's a joy. The life of the mind, it's a great thing. It doesn't mean we don't enjoy life physically. Of course we do. But we learn to do it. We learn to do it well. We learn to lead it, the physical, with the mental, with the intellect. And so that's what we're aiming for here in Christian classical education. I may have missed a bunch of things. I teach at a Christian classical school in Louisville right now, and it's been a great experience. It's been a lot of learning experience for me. And as I said, this is a worldview. This isn't merely something you do to your kids or with your kids or for your kids. It's not merely a book you read. This is a whole way of looking at life. Just think through this. Let yourself wash yourself in this so that when 50 Shades of Grey comes along, you're not duped by it. You're not duped by it. You've seen this before. You've seen this type of lust. You've seen society take these turns before in history, and you've seen what had happened, and you've seen God's providence in it, and you can pick out what is good poetry and what is good art and music and what's good in movies, and how to sift through and discern them and not merely be washed by them. We want to produce people who are eternally relevant. Not temporally relevant for the next 5 minutes, like Justin Bieber or somebody in the media, and then they're gone. We want people to be eternally relevant, and that's what Christianity is. We believe we have truth handed down once for all, and that we are maintaining it and passing it on. We're not developing it. We're not evolving it. We're curators. We possess it. We guard it. And we pass it on to our children. We pass that culture, that heritage, that rich heritage that's ancient, and it anchors you so that you're not tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine and storm that happens to come up with every new generation that claims that it's different and that their parents don't understand because they have new experiences that no one knows about. No, this is old, and it's solid, and it's not going anywhere. On Christ, the solid rock, we stand. All other ground is sinking sand. So my encouragement to you is to get involved in the Christian classical education and the movement. Become yourself a Christian classicist, someone who thinks like this, who isn't merely vapid and changing and fleeting with the age. And one of our goals is to not be trendy like that, but to be everlasting, right? We have eternal life, act like that now. C.S. Lewis said, whatever is not eternal is eternally out of date. And that's what we're aiming for. I encourage you to read his Abolition of Man, read Douglas Wilson's Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, or read Dorothy Sayers' essay, it's online. I think it's also The Lost Tools of Learning. You can just Google it and it's online. These are helpful resources. You can also email me at thomas.acord@gmail.com. Love to hear what you thought of today's show. Thanks for listening and see you next time. Bye.